The next case of the day is State v. Sammy S. Mirza. Mr. Pollack, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, it's always nice to be back at my alma mater. This was the Pie Room, for those of us who went, it's certainly changed over the years. In any event, my name is Sandy Pollack here on behalf of Mr. Mirza, the appellant in this case. This comes before the court after a jury verdict of guilty for first-degree sexual assault, a Class 2 felony, wherein Mr. Mirza was sentenced to 8 to 15 years. The court this morning focused on best arguments. My best argument for reversal and remand is prosecutorial misconduct. My client doesn't take those allegations lightly, nor do I. I've tried well over 200 jury cases. In this case, the prosecutor misstepped. Prosecutors, specifically in their closing arguments, cannot inflame prejudices or excite passion. Their personal opinions as to the credibility of witnesses or guilt or innocence are not an appropriate place to be dealt with in closing argument. Now, prosecutors can make spirited arguments. I understand that. And prosecutors can highlight the believability of their witnesses. But they cross the line when there's an expression of their personal beliefs rather than the summation of the evidence. This court has noted that misconduct cannot be neatly defined, but it should never be allowed to undermine a defendant's right to a fair trial. It's kind of a situation of, you know it when you see it. You know it when you hear it. The record is rife with several instances of misconduct which result in plain error. If we don't fix this, it's not fair to Mr. Mirza. In this case, the prosecutor's comments in closing were not a summation of the evidence with respect to two different issues. Number one, my client's need for an interpreter. The record reflects that at every step throughout the pretrial proceedings, through county court, all the way through district court, and up through trial, that Mr. Mirza required an interpreter. The county attorney never brought up to the court that he felt that Mr. Mirza didn't need an interpreter. Mr. Mirza, I'm sure the state will point out, has been in the United States for several years. He took classes at Southeast Community College. He worked at Molex. Mr. Mirza testified that although his classes were in English, he used an app on his phone to help interpret. He's far from fluent. Look at the record. He's far from fluent in the English language, much less legal jargon in a complicated criminal procedure.
What did the prosecutor actually say?
He said that basically that Mr. Mirza's use of an interpreter and his claims that he didn't really understand were a charade. That basically Mr. Mirza is trying to pull the wool over our eyes, over the jury's eyes, and say, he can't understand anything, you should be more sympathetic to me, when that's not the evidence at all.
And what was your response to that? What did you...
I wasn't trial counsel, but if I was there, object.
Is there any objection in this?
Not an objection, and that's ineffective assistance, and that's my second best argument in regards to reversal and remand.
Mr. Pollack, wasn't linguistic proficiency a proper subject for the prosecutor's closing argument?
No, because the theory of the defense, the theory of defense was not that Mr. Mirza didn't understand no. Now, if that was the theory of the defense, absolutely. But the theory of the defense was this was a consensual sexual encounter, as we can see from the record. It's not, did Mr. Mirza understand, not understand what was going on? But what happens at closing, and this is the second prosecutorial misconduct that I'm alleging, is that the prosecutor says, in his own words, I'm going to get on my soapbox. He uses those words, soapbox. That means his opinion. That is improper in closing. What should trial counsel have done? Object. Did he? No. That's ineffective assistance. Because there was prosecutorial misconduct.
Have you reviewed our case law on comments by prosecutors in closing argument?
Yes.
Where would you put this facts in the sort of context of what we have said about those various
I think it's right up there, especially in this day and age when we're dealing with immigrants and the political climate that's going on here in the United States and in Nebraska, and the court has set forth an analysis, a five-prong analysis, in dealing with whether does it meet that line. And in this case, it does. Number one, does the prosecutor's conduct or remarks tend to mislead or unduly influence the jury? Of course it does. Directly misleading the jury about his personal opinion and the whole thing about the defendant's use of an interpreter being a charade. Number two, were they extensive? Were the prosecutor's comments extensive? And in this case, they were. Review the record. It went on for several minutes during closing, went on for several pages as it was typed up. This wasn't just a, oh, by the way, maybe Mr. Mirza doesn't need an interpreter. This went on. Number three, did defense counsel invite the remarks? No. This was in the prosecutor's first opening statement. Number four, whether the court provide a curative instruction? No. Trial counsel didn't ask for one. Ineffective assistance. We'll get to that in a minute. Number five, the strength of the evidence supporting the conviction. In this case, not a lot of physical evidence. This was basically he said, she said. And the jury deliberated for over a day and a half. That's a lot of work hours. If the jury came back with his conviction in 30 minutes, overwhelming support of the evidence. An hour, maybe two, but over a day and a half with split decisions going along the way, the strength of the evidence just wasn't here in this case.
Now, the appellant's attorney, trial attorney, excuse me, during redirect, did ask some questions about his ability to understand why the officer was interviewing him, correct?
Yes.
But that was after statements had already been made by the state.
Yes. In this case, there was also ineffective assistance. The court set forth a three-pronged test. Number one, was counsel deficient? Yes. A variety of issues came up that should have been dealt with. Number one, the trial counsel did not attempt to suppress my client's statements and did not inquire on cross-examination of the Jackson v. Deno, basically saying, whatever my client said, I'm not going to challenge, just let it all in. Should have challenged. Number two, did not object to the Snapchats. The Snapchats in this case, very vital piece of evidence. There is no authentication. And in fact, my client testified.
What sort of authentication are you claiming was missing on our record?
In order to authenticate, I don't know that the court has dealt with Snapchats, but it has dealt with text messages. So are they accurately transcribed and who sent it? In this case, my client testified that he didn't believe that the Snapchats were an accurate representation of the conversation. Now, Snapchats, as we all know, they disappear after you read them unless you save them. Now, you don't have to save all of them, but the ones that you choose to save will be there on your phone. And from what my client testified to is that there was more conversation that was going back and forth between him and the alleged victim.
Is this a rule of completeness objection or an authentication objection?
Authenticate?
Sounds to me more like rule of completeness.
I think it'd be either. But the long story short, Justice, is trial counsel didn't even stand up and object. Didn't give the chance for the judge to make a decision in regards to the authentication and the propriety of the Snapchats.
But your argument is the objection should have been lack of authentication, correct? Not a rule of completeness.
Agreed, but there also should have been a motion in limine, and it should have been dealt with even pre-trial, and none of that was done. And
Did the client testify?
He did.
And was he asked questions about the Snapchat and what information might have been missing?
He indicated that there were Snapchats that were missing from the record. Now, asking him to say exactly what was said a year before, that would be very difficult for any of us to answer, especially when there's a huge volume of Snapchats that go on between two people that are involved in some type of relationship. And finally, did not object, as I suggested to the court, during closing. That is ineffective. It's on the record. I'd ask the court to reverse remand, give Sammy Mirza a fair trial. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Klein, good morning again.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, I'm Kimberly Klein, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state in this matter. Your Honor, with respect to the prosecutorial misconduct claim, the state explained why it made the comments that it did. The prosecutor said he felt he needed to demonstrate to the jury that Mirza spoke English and spoke well enough to understand that he was being told to stop by the victim in this case. And I think that is an issue because the victim's testimony clearly showed that their initial conduct was in fact consensual, but as things progressed along, she told him, stop, no, I don't want to do this. And in response, he not only did not stop, he became more aggressive. He simply continued on to do what he was doing and declined to do so. So I think the nature and his ability to understand is indeed an issue in this particular case.
Was the defense that he didn't understand no, or that he just had a different story? And does that matter to the analysis?
Well, I think it does matter to some degree, but his defense was that it was all consensual. However, I think the issue of his ability to understand is essentially at issue because of the victim's testimony and the nature of the defendant's conduct in response to that. She also said that the victim said she knew him through their classes that they took together at Southeast Community College. They were both in courses studying to be certified nursing assistants, which involves rather complex medical testimony, all sorts of anatomy. It involves somebody being required to have a rather complete understanding of English and what it, how it applies to different parts of, medical profession. The victim said he was in one of my classes. We did some kind of studying, basically via text messaging and electronically together. He was actually able to explain some things to me that I didn't understand about that. And she says, I speak English. That's it. I don't have any other linguistic skills.
I'm not totally understanding how his English language skill is at issue.
His English language skill is at issue because if he understood, the bottom line is basically, I think as the prosecutor explained, if he understands English well enough to take medical courses at a college level to pursue a degree, essentially a nursing degree, then the fact that he is purporting to require an interpreter here is just simply
Did the defense claim that he, was it any part of the defense that I don't understand English, I couldn't have understood, no? Anything in the record you can point us to where that was raised as part of the defense?
Was it his particular defense? No, that was not his espoused defense. But
what,
I think
what would be the purpose of the prosecutor's comment of referring to the interpreter? What would be the value as related to the evidence?
The value as related to the evidence is that essentially it's, and I think they basically said this. It's a ploy, if you will, to garner sympathy. He understands English well enough to take these courses, but he wants to portray himself as this poor little immigrant who doesn't speak the language, and so he requires this interpreter.
Is that a collateral matter?
I don't think it's necessary.
Is it color? I mean, most folks who testify mostly wish to be believed.
They do, but...
Is the prosecutor trying to make a not-so-subtle point about the veracity of the defendant and whether the jury should believe the defendant's testimony? He's lying to you about needing an interpreter, so he must be lying about everything else? Was that appropriate?
I think that was the message. It was kind of in a roundabout way, and I think that's entirely appropriate. You're always, I think, at liberty to point out essentially what their credibility is and what might impact it.
I think the parameters tend to be that it's up to you fact finders to determine credibility, right, rather than the prosecutor tell you who's telling the truth and so forth.
And I don't dispute that, but I think the prosecutors also, and both parties, frankly, are entitled to point out various factors which would affect the credibility of any particular witness.
Is using an interpreter fair game for a credibility determination?
I think under circumstances like this, it probably is. There's a difference between requiring an interpreter and having an interpreter. And I see nothing in the record here that indicates that this individual required an interpreter. Yes, he had one.
There was nothing inappropriate about him requesting an interpreter.
No.
English being his second language, is there?
Nothing ipso facto, no.
And the state never objected to an interpreter?
No, they did not. They did not. Similarly, the defendant never objected to the state or the state's closing comments on this. So we actually think ultimately our first argument is that this whole prosecutorial misconduct complaint is waived on appeal unless this court finds it to be plain error, as it has in some past cases. But I think ultimately the prosecutor's comments, as you look at the entire case, were probably fair game, and they did appropriately go towards his credibility because...
How does it relate to ineffective assistance of counsel?
Well, apparently, I understand his complaint to be that counsel was ineffective for not objecting to the state's closing comments as being improper.
And I beg your pardon, and this is different counsels in trial on appeal than trial counsel.
That's correct, yes. So he is obliged to raise that in order to preserve it for post-conviction proceedings. Although I'm a little confused by the assignment of error, because I think he refers to assignment of error 4, which is excessive sentence, but then he goes back and discusses assignment of error, which is actually 2, which is the prosecutorial misconduct. So I'm not sure that he's actually appropriately preserved that assignment of error for post-conviction. I guess that will, of course, be up to this court, but I think the assignment of error says one thing and his argument says another, and typically this court has always said that your assignment of error delineates what your arguments can appropriately encompass, and that being the rule, I think he has therefore waived the ineffective assistance of counsel claim under these particular circumstances.
Without overstating the case, it's been commented, let's see if I can use the totally non-political vocabulary, that a reference to interpreters and immigrants is going to be a dog whistle, as it were, for the jury's consideration.
I don't know that I necessarily buy that. I would think the jury would be sitting there scratching its collective head too, going, okay, this guy's taking medical courses, college level. He doesn't have obviously any problems with those. He's able to discuss medical terminology in English with another student, explain some things to her. What's he doing with an interpreter here? I'm a little confused by that. And this is not a complicated case. Listen, legally, it's not complicated. As he said, it's simply a he said, she said sort of thing. She either allowed him to do it or she didn't. There's nothing complex about that. There are no complicated legal terms.
Your suggestion is, they'd say, why is he using an interpreter?
I think the jury would probably have to sit
and the meaning of that in terms of deliberations is what?
I'm not sure I understand.
Would they therefore say he's inappropriately invoking an interpreter and therefore he's not credible?
I think they could sit back. I think the jury could sit back and say, okay, he's basically faking not being able to understand English. This makes me wonder what else, you know, I think they could sit there and say, okay, if he's faking that, I wonder what else he may or may not be faking. The text messages...
And the remainder of the closing was, I don't think he's truthful.
And the remainder of the closing was, yeah, I don't think he's truthful.
So
I
didn't have to connect the dots.
Yeah. Well, the victim's testimony alone made him look untruthful. The Snapchats that were offered and the text messages that were offered clearly show that he understood that he had done something wrong. Yeah, he offered some explanation for it, like in his culture, even if you don't think you've done anything wrong, which he apparently did not, you go ahead and apologize so you don't lose a
and
friend.
That came in for the jury's consideration.
Yes, that was absolutely came in through the victim's testimony, and the Snapchats were shown and offered. And he repeatedly basically pestered her, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I won't do it again, I'll behave, I'll be a good boy. I think these are his exact words. I don't want to lose you as a friend. Basically, he treated it as no big deal and just kept essentially nagging at her and pestering her to forgive him for what he had done. So I think that is also consciousness of guilt and also factors into the, yes, I understand what was going on and I'm trying to find my way out of this kind of thing. I see my time is up. If there are no further questions, we would ask that the judgment be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. So that concludes arguments for today.